Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, formerly senior editor of the New American Magazine, now a talk show host in his own right. He does daily blogs, sometimes three or four times a week, and so he writes books, keep busy with his six children. But anyway, it's always a pleasure to have William with us every Friday evening at this time, as he brings us abreast of so many of the things that are taking place today. And of course, we actually have a chance to read his blog articles very often. Joel Skousen will pull them down and post them at worldaffairsbrief.com, and so I go over that. But anyway, William, what are we going to be talking about this evening?
Dr. Stan, thanks again for having me on as a guest. It's always a pleasure. We have to talk about tomorrow's anniversary, of course, and many of the media distractions that have been confected in order to reinforce the official party line of the regime and to keep people from asking questions that we've not been given authorization to ponder. And one of the things that we have to recognize here is that what happened on September 11th of 2001, irrespective of what you think about the official account, the official narrative, irrespective of your particular take on which of the many contending theories behind that incident would be true, what happened was a catalytic event. It was something that was anticipated. It was something that was prepared for. It was something that was meant to be the inauguration of pretty much a new order of things with respect to our political environment, with respect to our security system here as a country. There were, as you know, and as we pointed out before, plans literally on the desks of key policymakers, including the president, months in advance of 9/11, that were anticipating some kind of a sudden, violent, and traumatic shock in order to begin. And they had to do with the infrastructure, what I call the Homeland Security State, and the enhancement of the powers of the presidency, which are already dangerously overdrawn in terms of what the Constitution authorizes. The enhancement of the powers of the presidency into something akin to those of a short-term dictator that is literally above and beyond accountability. And just in the last several days, we've seen a judicial decision handed down by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is meant to insulate people from the Bush administration for accountability for things that they had done, which were, by any metric, violations of statutory law, violations of the Constitution with respect to this program of so-called extraordinary rendition, which is basically kidnapping by the CIA of people from countries abroad or from this country as well, and taking these people to secret dungeons overseas that are run by professional torturers for the purpose not of discovering intelligence, actionable intelligence with respect to terrorist threats, but reinforcing and validating the decisions and assumptions, the official nostrums of the regime with respect to terrorism. That's the sort of thing that is the immediate outgrowth of what happened on September 11th, 2001. That's what was prepared and planned for. There are many things that can be said about why the official narrative is wrong, but the most important thing is the reaction that was the fruit of that action. And we're living with those consequences today, and it's becoming a very ominous environment indeed for those of us who love freedom.
Well, I think it was the important thing to realize, of course, that they needed an incident, Pearl Harbor. If you read the report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, by the neocons at their website, and it's included, the whole report's included in my syllabus on Iraq, the Untold Story. They talked about we had to have a new Pearl Harbor. As Zbigniew Brzezinski talked about, we had to have a perceived external threat in his book, the Grand Chessboard. They had to have an incident to get us into a war. And they got one on September 11th. Go right ahead, William.
The important thing about this incident on 9/11 and the uses that have been made of it, the important thing to recognize here is that the foundational lie that we have to accept or be banished into whatever intellectual and social ghetto is reserved for extremists and people that are not in the mainstream, the foundational lie we have to accept is the assumption that history began on 9/11, that there really was no antecedent, there was no build-up, there was no preface, there was no prelude to what happened, that literally out of a cloudless late summer sky early in that September morning, we were attacked without provocation and without a backstory by people who are irrationally devoted to the destruction of our country because they hate freedom, they hate our culture, which they consider to be decadent, that they're part of an incorrigibly, incurably troublesome mass of humanity that simply has to be dealt with through unremitting force, and that from that point into the foreseeable future, we are a nation permanently at war. It's an odd sort of a war in that it's not headline news. There's a curiously antiseptic quality to the way that it is covered. The really newsworthy developments having to do with the deaths of our fighting men and unfortunately fighting women in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere are given minimal coverage. You don't see caskets for the most part returning, flag-draped coffins carrying the mortal remains of husbands, fathers, sons, and of course mothers, daughters, and wives coming back to the United States. You don't have the dislocations, the visible dislocations of the economy that came about in World War II when you literally had a fascist system of command and control in charge of the economy, as was the case in World War I. However, there are economic dislocations that we're living with. One of the reasons why we're on the precipice, or actually we're not on the precipice, we've crossed the precipice and we're in free fall now down the trackless depths of what will be the greatest depression in human history. A lot of it has to do with the $2 trillion or so that has been put to the torch in this huge exercise of corrupt graft and aggression that is the so-called war on terrorism. That's, of course, something that people don't recognize, and they should, I would hope, at this point, come to understand that you can't simply burn up $2 trillion in pure sunk costs and destruction, which is what warfare is, without there being immediate and very deleterious consequences for the domestic economy. But all of these things, of course, rest on the assumption that we simply cannot understand what is behind the rage of the people who have been implicated in, whether accurately or inaccurately, I think the latter is more nearly the case, implicated in the attack on 9/11. Supposedly, we're dealing once again with people who are bit players, if you will, in this drama that has been scripted for us.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris. William is just talking about the script. There was a script for 9/11. And
yes.
If this was to take us, just justify going into a war with the Muslim world. It had been planned for a long time. The CIA had been financing this radical Islamic movement. I mean, who is it who funds the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt? Why the American intelligence agencies? Of course, we had the best enemy money could buy. If you want to verify this, there's a wonderful book called The Devil's Game by Robert Ray. We carry that, and we were financing this whole Islamic terrorist movement, and we even have a clipping from the Washington Post called When the ABCs of Jihad, pointing out that the USAID spent $51 million basically printing textbooks in Arabic to be used in the madras of the Islamic schools, pushing this radical form of Islam. And when asked why they would do that sort of thing, they said, well, of course, the students would have used the books, of course, if it hadn't been pushing this radical form of Islam. I mean, who was it who actually trained the Mujahideen during the Afghan war and this radical form of Islam? Why we did? Well, we said we wanted to give them a reason to fight the Russians, so we schooled them in this radical form of Islam. And then, of course, we financed Al-Qaeda and we financed the Taliban. And if you remember the speech that George Bush gave on the 20th or 21st of September 2001, just explaining why we were going to war, and he pointed at that time that the United States was the largest funder, a source of funds for Afghanistan. Well, that was the Taliban at the time, that the Taliban controlled it. We were funding the Taliban right up until September 11th, 2001. But you go right ahead.
That's entirely correct. And one other piece of the puzzle that I'd like to mention, I mentioned it before, but it bears repeating, is an interview that the same Zbigniew Brzezinski you mentioned gave in the January 1998 issue of Le Nouvel Observateur, which is a French newspaper, and this is the English translation of part of that interview. According to the official version of history, CIA aid to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan began during 1980, that is to say after the Soviet Army invaded Afghanistan, which was on the 24th of December 1979. But the reality secretly guarded until now, bear in mind this once again is from 1998 that these disclosures were made, is completely otherwise. Indeed, it was July 3rd, 1979 that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day, I, that is Zbigniew Brzezinski, wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. They wanted to lure, in other words, the Soviets into Afghanistan. And Brzezinski, when asked about this by his French interviewer, said that he thought that it was worthwhile to bring about this move on the grand international geopolitical chessboard, even at the expense of creating the radical Muslim movement, the Mujahideen, which coalesced into the Taliban, and another element of it, of course, became Al-Qaeda. And the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence agency, which is, for all intents and purposes, a satellite of the CIA, was the spine. It was the spinal column that held together that radical Mujahideen. And Pakistan now is the chief and ground floor, if you will, for what remains the command level directive of this club called Al-Qaeda. And what's going to happen over the next several weeks, in all probability, Michael Scheuer, who's the former head of the CIA's Osama bin Laden tracking unit, Alex Station, within the last couple of weeks, has said it's not a matter of if, but when you have another military coup in Pakistan. They have them with something akin to metronomic regularity. They're due for one. But owing to the torrential and catastrophic apocalyptic flooding that has afflicted that country, and the fact that the current president was conspicuously indifferent to what was going on in the country, and the only element of that government seen as competent being is the military is almost certainly going to take over, and as a result, you're going to have an escalation in the civil war that exists right now between, on the one hand, the co-creation of the United States and Pakistani intelligence, which is the Al-Qaeda network in Pakistan, and the Pakistani government, which is the nominal ally of the United States in the so-called war on terror. So things are going to get really interesting in that respect in Pakistan. And all this, of course, is going to reinforce the most important dynamic here, which our rulers have been profiting on, which they have been trying to exploit and cultivate, and that is the supposed need for enhanced powers here domestically to regiment the economy and to regiment our lives in every particular. And just once again, in the last couple of weeks, you have a couple of really important developments here that show the perfect continuity between Barack Obama and his predecessor, George W. Bush, when it comes to the distended powers of the war presidency. This decision I had adverted to a couple of minutes ago out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has to do with the case of Binyam Mohammed et al. Versus Jepson Data Plan Incorporated and the U.S. government. Jepson Data Plan Incorporated was involved in the so-called, if you will, rendition airline, or the terror taxi service, to use the title of a book describing how this operates. This fleet of aircraft that were being used to ferry people back and forth to the secret sites overseas in places like Morocco and Egypt and Jordan and some of the former KGB dungeons in places like Poland and the Czech Republic. And at least one of the planes used in this operation, incidentally, was also used as a narcotics ferry, if you will, an airborne narcotics ferry by one of the Mexican drug cartels. That's something I wrote about a couple of months ago. Actually, I wrote about it a couple of years ago, then revised that a couple of months ago, talking about the involvement of some of the beneficiaries of the TARP bailout in the Mexican narcotics trade. But the same aircraft that was being used as a torture taxi by the CIA was being used by Mexican drug smugglers to bring narcotics into the country. Narcotics, of course, being one of the chief ways that the CIA finances its operations. But this decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said essentially that these people don't have the right to sue the United States government and those corporate entities that worked as contractors in this regime of torture and illegal detention, because of something called the state secrets privilege. Now, the state secrets privilege is not mentioned by the Constitution. It's not among the enumerated powers of the federal government. Ergo, it is not a legitimate claim that there is something called a state secrets privilege. What it is in practice is an apparently all-encompassing and unspecified right of anybody who's the President of the United States and any of the agents or colleagues or allies or, better put, cohorts in crime, whom he wants to cover with this blanket, the security blanket, to invoke this privilege as a way of preventing investigations of malfeasance that have to do with so-called national security issues. If you're, for instance, a member of an executive branch agency such as the CIA, and you do something, or you're plausibly accused of doing something, which is facially illegal, criminal by virtue of statute, unconstitutional, and has a crime against the Constitution, if you can impute some kind of a connection to national security and say that the very act of investigating what you're alleged to have done would violate national security, then that pretty much stops in its tracks whatever effort exists to bring about accountability. The assumption being here, I guess, that the power of the government and the privileges of the elite in the government are much, much more important and much worthy of preservation than the rights of innocent people who are abused by government.
But I think it's what's so important is the question is, whose security and who are we keeping the information from? Are we keeping it from Osama bin Laden? Are we keeping it from Putin over in Moscow? Are we keeping it from the Chinese dictator in Beijing? Are we keeping the truth from the American people?
Yeah.
Because if the American people knew the truth, they would be incensed. And Sydney, basically, if the truth ever came out, that, of course, the buildings came down on September 11th because of something was done by one of our intelligence agencies or someone working for our government, if the truth ever came out, that we were torturing innocent people, and, of course, the truth ever came out about any of the other major crimes, for instance, the fact that the State Department allowed the transfer of the technology to build a nuclear bomb to Pakistan and helped them build a bomb, so they have a couple of hundred nuclear bombs over there. If the American people knew that, this is what Sybil Edmonds tried to bring out when she took her case all the way to the Supreme Court. She wanted to let the American people know that the State Department, the CIA, the FBI, they all knew that we were providing the material and the know-how for Pakistan to build a nuclear weapon. But we couldn't let that information out in the name of national security. But who were we protecting? We certainly weren't, trying to keep Osama bin Laden from knowing, because he knew. We weren't trying to keep the communists in Russia or China. And the significant thing is, everybody in the world knows this story. It was printed eventually in the London Times, but totally blacked out in America. And the whole thing is, they want to conceal the information from the American people. That's what national security is about. It is to keep the brotherhood of darkness in power. Go ahead.
That's exactly right. It's intended to protect them from us, as is the so-called Homeland Security apparatus. This is something that I used to point out immediately after 9/11. In the months immediately after 9/11, when you had people in camouflage with semi-automatic weapons patrolling the corridors of American airports, which is something that I had seen during the military coup in Guatemala in 1983 when I was there, I pointed out that if you want to understand what's really going on here, take a look at the way they're treating the entire public as a pool of suspects. They're not treating us as people subject to protection. They're treating us as people who are essentially criminal suspects. They're treating us as people from whom the government has to be protected. And everything that has happened in the realm of Homeland Security and counterterrorism since 2001, or earlier, actually, since 1996 or earlier, has been based on that premise that the highest purpose of the law is to protect the ruling elite from the people at large and to keep the people terrified, at least at a low level, so as to support this unsustainable state of affairs.
I think Machiavelli said something like that, and the Prince, you know, you've got to have an enemy, you know, a frightful enemy to rally the people behind the Prince. I mean, how are you going to get the people to support the government if the government isn't protecting them from that wicked enemy, whoever it would be, Goldfarb or yours, or the Osama bin Laden, or there's got to be an enemy, and they create one very, very efficiently. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Go right ahead.
It's fascinating to me. Dr. Stan, you just mentioned the fact that there are media blackouts of very important developments, the Sybil Edmonds revelations being a really good example of what we're talking about with respect to the transfer of nuclear technology to Pakistan. Good heavens, Pakistan and India are ready to lob nuclear bombs at each other. You could have a war break out in the subcontinent that would go nuclear very quickly. It almost came to blows of a nuclear nature back in 1998. That's one of those I wake up screaming type memories. And so when you're talking about that type of treasonous transfer of nuclear technology to Pakistan, that's something that literally could result in the deaths of millions or tens of millions of people in a cataclysmic war with global consequences. But most Americans are not aware of this. You have to go overseas in order to find people who are at least somewhat conversant with this, or to find yourself in the presence of people who have, without permission, been delving into questions that the government and the people behind the government really don't want us to look into. It's one of the enduring paradoxes of our time that you're actually likely to be better informed about what's going on in American domestic politics if you watch Russian television or if you read Pravda, which is not being published by the Communist Party anymore. Actually, the Communist Party version of Pravda went out of business about 10 or 15 years ago and was bought by a group of Russian nationalists whose politics I don't like a whole lot better, but at least they're not totalitarian socialists. They tend to be more, if you will, the Russian version of sort of a Buchananite version of nationalism, and I do have issues with that. A lot of it's commendable, some of it I disagree with, but they're at least honest about what's going on in the world, and they seem to be a lot more perceptive about our descent into socialism. Having experienced this and having problems with what's going on right now, they can at least be somewhat objective critics of what's happening in the United States, and chances are if you read Pravda today, you're better informed than if you read the wan, pale imitations of Soviet-era Pravda, such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, and so forth. But the most important development here, I think, in all of this welter of confusion that we're dealing with after 9/11, is the emergence of this homeland security apparatus presided over by an essentially dictatorial president with unlimited powers, with absolutely no restraint, effective restraint by law, that supposedly has moral standing and constitutional authority to murder anybody on his order and his directive by way of on-site, what they used to call wet work, carried out by a human assassination squad, or by way of a remote-controlled drone. That's one option. Or you can have people put away indefinitely as terrorist suspects, as unlawful enemy combatants, and so forth, and you can have them subjected to torture and sent by the CIA to a distant foreign dungeon while they will be tortured by people who are very, very well-versed in those dark arts, who are acting as subcontractors for Washington. And this Binyam Mohamed case is so remarkable because the court starts off by talking about the state secrets doctrine. The Ninth Circuit Court writes as follows. It was a panel, an 11-judge panel, that ruled 6-5 in favor, essentially, of dismissing this lawsuit. They write, we are bound to follow the Supreme Court's admonition that, quote, even the most compelling necessity cannot overcome the claim of privilege if the court is ultimately satisfied that state secrets are at stake. In other words, it doesn't matter what they've done, if there are secrets at stake that implicate top policymakers and it has some connection to national security.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back and go right ahead, William.
Right. If there's some connection to national security and there are secrets at stake that policymakers want to keep, that it doesn't matter what they've done according to this doctrine, the people don't have standing to sue because their rights as individuals are trumped irremediably by the so-called state secrets privilege. And then they go into the factual allegations here being made by these plaintiffs. They stipulate to the allegations. In other words, under existing civil guidelines, the courts have to put the most favorable construction on the claims of the plaintiffs. They have to examine them in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, all these claims. Here are some examples of what we're talking about here. Plaintiff Abu Ilkasim Britel, a 40-year-old Italian citizen of Moroccan origin, was arrested and detained in Pakistan on immigration charges after several months in Pakistani detention Brittle was allegedly transferred to the custody of American officials. These officials dressed Brittle, I believe it's Brittle, not Brittle, in a diaper and a torn T-shirt and shackled and blindfolded him for a flight to Morocco. Once in Morocco, he says he was detained incommunicado by Moroccan security services at the Tamara prison, where he was beaten, deprived of sleep and food, and threatened with sexual torture, including sodomy with a bottle and castration. After being released and re-detained, Brittle says he was coerced into signing a false confession, convicted of terrorism-related charges, and sentenced to 15 years in a Moroccan prison. Morocco, by the way, is a pretty horrible place to live if you have any attachment to civil liberties. To continue, this is the one that really gets me, and I've written about this before. Plaintiff Binyan Mohammed, a 28-year-old Ethiopian citizen and legal resident of the United Kingdom, was arrested in Pakistan on immigration charges. Mohammed was allegedly flown to Morocco under conditions similar to those described above, where he claims he was transferred to the custody of Moroccan security agents. These Moroccan authorities allegedly subjected Mohammed to severe physical and psychological torture, including routinely beating him and breaking his bones. He says they cut him with a small scalpel all over his body, including on his penis, and poured hot stinging liquid into the open wounds. He was blindfolded and handcuffed while being made to listen to extremely loud music day and night. After 18 months in Moroccan custody, Mohammed was allegedly transferred back to American custody and flown to Afghanistan. He claims he was detained there in a CIA dark prison, most likely at Bagram Airport, or Bagram Air Force Base, where he was kept in near-permanent darkness and subjected to loud noise such as the recorded screams of women and children 24 hours a day. Mohammed was fed sparingly and irregularly, and in 4 months he lost between 40 and 60 pounds. Eventually, he was transferred to the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where he remained for nearly 5 years. He was released and returned to the United Kingdom during the pendency of this appeal. He was never found guilty of anything. They were trying to torture him into corroborating an accusation being made against Jose Padilla, an American citizen who was detained at Chicago's O'Hare Airport in 2002 and then held for several years, tortured to the point where he literally lost his mind. Supposedly, he was involved in the plot to detonate a radiological bomb. They dropped those charges entirely. He was eventually convicted on charges that had nothing to do with alleged terrorist activities in the United States. He was stripped of any standing before the law by being proclaimed by President Bush an unlawful enemy combatant. That deprived him of his habeas corpus, rights. It deprived him, supposedly, I guess, of any immunity to being tortured. The people who held Binyan Mohammed were trying to get him to make a false confession that would implicate Mr. Padilla. That was the whole point of torturing this man. When he was being flown to Guantanamo, he was subjected to a physical checkup on the plane. And during this examination, his shirt was taken off, and the stars that covered his body were so grotesque, so lurid, and so repulsive that it literally caused a female CIA officer on the plane to break down crying. She couldn't believe that he had been mistreated that way. But according to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, because trying to vindicate this man's rights would somehow transgress the state secrets doctrine by revealing, holding in daylight these dark deeds of criminal behavior that have been committed under the color of supposed authority, because doing so would mean revealing secrets that are criminal secrets, he doesn't have any standing to seek redress in U.S. courts. Here's another case. Bishr al-Rawi, a 39-year-old Iraqi citizen and legal resident of the United Kingdom, was arrested in Gambia while traveling on legitimate business. He was also diapered and shackled and taken to Afghanistan, where he was put in a dark hole and beaten and abused. He was transferred to Guantanamo, where he was tortured and then released without criminal charges. According to the doctrine that prevails right now, this is something that any president can do to anybody, anytime, for any reason, and we don't have any recourse. That's the true legacy of 9/11.
And I think that the average American said, well, this really couldn't be true. Well, you've never read Major General Tacuba's description of what happened to Abu Ghraib. General Tacuba was told, he's a major general, he said, well, you're going to be appointed to do this. If you tell the truth, why, you'll be forced out of the military. He told the truth, he was forced out of the military.
There you go.
And that tells us a lot about the American military. I would be ashamed to serve today. Unfortunately, I hate to say it, but we've come to that point.
Far across the sea.
Well, I love to play that song because it reminds me of what America used to be before the Brotherhood of Darkness took total control of our government. We have a visible government. We have an invisible government, ladies and gentlemen. And if you don't have the courage to stand against them, why, you may not be able to stand against them. You'll just have to go along with whatever they decree, and it may very well be your children or your wife that's tortured. Go right ahead.
Here's something that I find interesting as well. Next week, according to a letter that was sent by Barack Obama to the Congress, today, the state of emergency, which was declared by George W. Bush on September 14th of 2011, will be extended at least another year. And that means that as of Tuesday, we'll be entering the 10th year. We'll be rounding out the decade of life under emergency rule. That's something that I don't think has a precedent in American history. Although, of course, there are these accumulating states of emergency having to do with various passing transitory quarrels with various unsavory regimes overseas. I don't think that there has ever been a decade-long block of time that has been devoted to one continuing, all-encompassing, all-sufficient defining emergency, such as the so-called war on terror. And this once again reinforces the idea that Mr. Obama, for all of his vaunted talk of change and bringing about some kind of a radical transformation of the way that business is done by the federal government, is very much of a piece with his predecessor in pretty much every way that doesn't involve simple aesthetics. You're dealing here with somebody who's just as much a corporatist in outlook as George W. Bush. He's marginally more articulate, perhaps a little bit better educated, maybe a little bit more more composed in terms of his personal demeanor, and he tends to be just a little bit to the left of the artificially defined center, whereas George W. Bush was supposedly to the right. I think George W. Bush is every bit to the left, every bit as far to the left as Obama is on most issues of consequence. But once again, there's not been any sudden or noticeable changes in policy here, in spite of the fact that establishment outlet, retail outlet B has taken over from establishment retail outlet A. And we find the conversation about our political situation being dominated by...
Hold that thought. This is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is William Grigg. And William, before we go on, I want you to tell our listeners how they can listen to your radio programs, how they can get to your blog, and how they can find your PayPal button.
I appreciate that, Dr. Stan. My blog is called Pro Libertate, and it's found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or go to Google or Bing or any of the other search engines and simply enter my last name, Grigg, G-R-I-G-G, and Pro Libertate, L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E, Pro Libertate. And if you enter William Grigg, Pro Libertate should be the first return. If you enter Pro Libertate, my blog should be the first return. If you enter in Grigg and some combination of Pro Libertate, that usually works in terms of turning up the blog on the first try. And I try to update that blog between 3 and 4 times a week as my circumstances permit. Dr. Stanley mentioned my radio program. It's also called Pro Libertate. Pro Libertate Radio airs every Saturday evening from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time on the Liberty News Radio Network, which is found at libertynewsradio.com. On the homepage of Liberty News Radio, there are links to the archives of my program and also the archives of all the other programs offered at that radio network. They're also available as downloadable podcasts. And there's also a list of local affiliates for those who want to listen to the program over conventional terrestrial radio. Of course, it's available by way of live streaming on the Internet. There's practically every way that you can receive a broadcast program, you can find some format and some mode of reception through the Liberty News Radio website, libertynewsradio.com. I also write quite a bit for Lou Rockwell's website and the blog on lourockwell.com. lourockwell.com is one of the most widely read freedom-oriented websites in the world, and I've started to write as well for the Libertarian Standard, the Libertarian Standard blog. Just go to Google and type in Libertarian Standard. You should be able to find that. And you mentioned, Dr. Stan, that at the end of every essay I post on Pro Libertate, there is a place where people can make donations by way of PayPal if they have the means and if they're inclined to do so. I really do appreciate the fact that many people, particularly over the last couple of weeks, have been exceptionally generous in helping me and helping my family. and this is how I'm trying to support my family. You mentioned that we have six children, and that means that I don't get a whole lot of sleep. Even in the best of times, I find myself being pretty much over-scheduled, and I do really greatly, genuinely, deeply, and eternally appreciate everything that people have done to help us out. Literally, at the beginning, actually toward the end of last month, I should say, toward the middle of last month, I didn't know how we were going to make it through this month. And owing to the fact that many people have seen fit to impart of their substance with us by way of donating it to the PayPal site, we've been able to make provisions for this month and probably for next month as well. And we're pretty much like everybody else trying to get by week to week, month to month. It's a bit more of a struggle for us than it is for some. We're all pretty much in the same sinking ship, unfortunately. So I really do appreciate everything that people have done in order to help keep us afloat and help keep my website up and running and my radio program on the air. God bless you. It's really been something I value and appreciate, and it's very humbling.
And I really appreciate the fact that people are supporting you, and because I think your message is a very important one. But please go right ahead. You were just explaining to us how we are losing our freedom and the American people to sit idly by as the government increases its control over our lives, tortures people indiscriminately, and there's no outcry from the controlled media because the media is controlled. There's no outcry from our religious leaders because our seminaries are controlled and ministers are afraid to speak out, quite frankly. I mean, how many ministers have you ever heard speak out against the official government policy of acknowledging torture, and then any time people try to bring it out, why, it's always covered up with, oh, well, it's a national security, national secret. In the name of national security, we have to allow torture, and we can't let people have any redress at all. We can do whatever we want because we're protecting the American people. Go right ahead.
You just made reference, I think, Dr. Stan, to one of the fundamental forms of idolatry that the Bible talks about. One of my favorite passages, difficult to say you have a favorite passage, of course, in God's Word, but I think one of the most eternally relevant ones where politics is concerned is in the first Book of Samuel, chapter 8, where it's talking about how the Israelites wanted a king. Why did they want a king? They wanted a king in order to be led by their king on the battlefield, just like all the countries, all the nations, I should say, the kingdoms that surrounded them. And Samuel was told to give a rather detailed warning as to what would happen to the Israelites if they allowed themselves to be seduced away from the system they were living under, which was a wonderful patriarchal confederation that was, by our standards, almost anarchistic. They had laws, but they didn't have coercion. They had judges, they didn't have kings. The way that they adjudicated disputes, if there were disputes among these patriarchal groupings, was to go before the judges and have them arbitrate their disputes according to the law. They didn't have this vast and intrusive mechanism of coercion that we now call a government. Well, they didn't want that. They wanted a king. They wanted somebody who was going to be liveried like the monarchs who surrounded them, and somebody who with great pomp and pretense would be leading them on the battlefield. And so what Samuel said was that if you do this, you're going to end up having everything you do, everything you make, be perverted into a resource or an instrument of the king's will. He's going to take your sons, he's going to conscript your sons, he's going to take your daughters and make them labor in ways that would advance his interests rather than yours. He will take a huge portion of what you earn, which, of course, it would strike us as a pittance, given the fact that it wasn't until just a couple of weeks ago we started working for ourselves, given our tax burden. But from the perspective of the Israelites, who had the glorious blessing of living under what we'd have to call almost a sort of theocratic anarchism, it struck them as perverse that they would be taxed at the rates that they were being told they would have to pay.
It was one-tenth.
One-tenth
of ever. All I can say is that they were pikers at that time compared with the IRS.
That was confiscatory as far as they're concerned. As far as we're concerned, that seems like a pretty good deal. But the thing is, the whole thrust of what Samuel was warning them was that by allowing a king to be imposed on them for the purpose of building a warfare state, their lives, their fortunes, their property, their families were all going to be absorbed as resources to maintain the warfare state. That's where we are right now in this country. Granted, our warfare state is a little bit different because, you know, following the formula described in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, we have the perfumed depression of materialism. We find ourselves being distracted and lulled into a sense of complacency because of the material benefits of mass consumerism, so-called. We eat lousy diets. We consume a lousy diet of the informational equivalent of junk food. We find ourselves to be fat and torpid and while not necessarily happy, we're at least contented. But the fact is that what we should cherish, which is our freedom to develop our gifts, to improve our lot in life, to bequeath to our children a better standard of living, that's been stolen from us in order to fuel this omnivorous idol that is the warfare state. And so we find ourselves being caught in these manufactured undertows by the media appendage of the military-industrial homeland security complex, like this dingbat in Florida who suddenly became a global celebrity and something akin to a policy broker by virtue of his supposed plans to conduct a Koran burning to commemorate 9/11. This became pretty much the story dominating the news cycle for several days this past week, reinforcing a couple of perfectly toxic messages, the first of which being, of course, that we should consider ourselves to be in a state of either declared or incipient warfare with the entire Muslim world, you know, 1.5 billion people, which is a message, of course, that the war makers want us to believe. And secondly, that there's no point in asking any important questions about what happened on 9/11, because everything I needed to know about Islam I learned on 9/11. That, of course, is an inscription we're finding on bumper stickers and T-shirts. And that, of course, means we can't examine why 9/11 took place in terms of the foreign policy implications or investigate the possibility that we've not been told the real story as to who was behind 9/11, that maybe there was something here besides the standard narrative of 19 box-cutter-wielding Arabs who were responsible for this horrible cataclysm. Now, with respect to the question of 9/11 revisionism, I'm a persuadable skeptic. I am wholeheartedly convinced that the official account is entirely incorrect in terms of it being an unanticipated and unprovoked incident that the conscientious people in our government simply could not prevent. They could have prevented it. According to the standard narrative, they had ample opportunity to prevent it if the standard narrative were true. I'm not entirely convinced that the standard narrative was true. There are plenty of intelligent, reasonable people who are well-credentialed experts in the relevant fields who have examined the story and who find it wanting. But the important point that we should remember here is that we have to be able to ask the questions, we have to be able to assess what we're being told, and we have to be able to make intelligent, responsible judgments about the motivations and actions and the opportunism and the exploitive nature of the decisions being made by people in positions of power. There's a terrific piece that was just published by Eric Margolis. He's a veteran foreign affairs correspondent, born and raised in New York City. Until recently, he wrote for a newspaper, I believe, the Toronto Sun. He was recently fired from his position as a foreign affairs columnist for that newspaper because it was absorbed by the same neocon apparatus that has been so busy basically buying up what remains of the conservative media here in this country. This is what he has to say about 9/11, some of the unanswered questions that he finds provocative. I inspected the ruins of the New York Twin Towers, atop which I often dined right after the attack. Downtown Manhattan was enveloped by a hideous stinking miasma from the attack. I have never smelled anything so awful. It took me days to scrub the foul odor off my body. As a native New Yorker, I was shaken to the core by 9/11, but hardly surprised, as I had predicted a major attack on the U.S. 9 days earlier. You can actually go find that column on September 2nd. He said, "We're about to get clobbered because of the foreign policy that has been pursued by Washington." While visiting the Pentagon to consult on the Middle East, I also inspected its outside wall hit by a third hijacked aircraft. I saw photos of the impact site and could not understand what had happened to all the aircraft wreckage. There was almost none. In 1993, I was hijacked over Germany on a Lufthansa flight bound for Cairo. The Ethiopian hijacker took us all the way back to New York City. The hijacker was threatening to crash our A310 jumbo jet into Wall Street. Our flight was shadowed by U.S. F-15 fighters that had orders to shoot if necessary. Where, then, was U.S. air defense on September 11, 2001? A day after 9/11, I was asked on CNN if Osama bin Laden was behind the attack. We have yet to see the evidence, I replied. I maintain this position today. Bin Laden denied he or al-Qaeda was behind 9/11 and the deaths of nearly 3,000 people. The plot was hatched in Hamburg, Germany, and Madrid, Spain, not in Afghanistan. By the way, to the extent that there was this element here, whether it's a cover story, whether these the people who actually were involved, the people involved in the Hamburg cell are a direct outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood element that had been funded by the CIA beginning no later than 1950. There's a new book out that goes into the background here of how the Hamburg cell, that was organized at this radical mosque in that German city, was composed of people who had been employed by both the Soviets and by the Nazis, hardcore Muslim activists, irredentists of the Muslim variety, who had been employed by the intelligence agencies of Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany. The CIA picked up their contract, so to speak, in the late 40s or early 50s, and the people involved at whatever level in 9/11 who were part of the Hamburg cell were part of that, were an outgrowth of the CIA effort that began 50 years ago.
What's the, and that's the name of the book, I haven't heard.
A Mosque in Munich.
A Mosque in Munich?
A Mosque in Munich.
Very good, thank you.
Yes, that's a very important book to pick up. It's written by somebody who's very establishmentarian in his outlook, and I don't agree with his prescriptions, I don't agree with all of his observations, but the thing I find really interesting is that he goes into great depth of detail describing the CIA's long-term involvement in funding and promoting the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a very important part of the story.
And people, unless you understand that we've created intentionally and purposely this whole radical Islamic movement, which I believe, of course, is a prelude to going to war with the Muslim world, and everybody said, oh, well, we don't want to go to war with the Muslim world. Well, then, if not, why did the CIA fund the Muslim Brotherhood? Why did they certainly program the Mujahideen during the 1980s when they were fighting the Russians? Why did they program any of these radical ideas? Why did USAID put out $51 million for textbooks? We'll be glad to send you the article out of the Washington Post. It's called The ABCs of Jihad. Why would you do that unless you wanted a radical Islamic movement? But go right ahead.
Yeah. Incidentally, Dr. Stan, I believe the name of the author of A Mosque in Munich is Ian Johnson. But if you look up A Mosque in Munich, you should be able to find recent reviews. And I believe there's actually also an interview, a video interview, a rather lengthy one, discussing the ideas of the book that's available as well. And to return here to what Eric Margolis has to say about the official story of the 9/11 incident, Pakistani Khalid Sheikh Mohammed claimed he was the mastermind after being tortured by near drowning 183 times by the CIA. While denying involvement, Osama bin Laden did say he believed the attack on New York was in part motivated by Israel's destruction of downtown Beirut during its 1982 invasion of Lebanon that inflicted some 18,000 civilian deaths. Tapes that appeared to confirm bin Laden's guilt were clumsy fakes. They were supposedly found in Afghanistan by the anti-Taliban Afghan Northern Alliance, which was created and funded by Russian intelligence. I had met Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan and told CNN viewers that he was not the man in the tapes. After 9/11, Secretary of State Colin Powell promised Americans the State Department would issue a white paper detailing bin Laden's guilt. Afghanistan's Taliban government asked for this document before it would extradite bin Laden, as the U.S. was demanding. The white paper was never produced, and the U.S. ignored proper legal procedure and invaded Afghanistan. We still wait for evidence. Let me interject here very quickly. The Taliban regime in Afghanistan wanted to be rid of bin Laden. They had been trying for months before September 11, 2001, to get the Bush administration to take bin Laden off their hands. There was a deal in the works before September 11th. Actually, there was not necessarily a deal in the works, but there was a deal on the table that would have prevented, or rather would have permitted Washington to take physical custody of Osama bin Laden. After 9/11, Colin Powell and George W. Bush, in his dramatic address before Congress, claimed that bin Laden was responsible and promised to provide evidence. Mr. Bush demanded that bin Laden be turned over to U.S. custody, or he would essentially, of his own supposed authority, inaugurate a war against Afghanistan. The Taliban reacted to that ultimatum by saying, show us the evidence, and if we find it convincing, we'll grab bin Laden and deliver him to you, or whatever portions of him we can find. That's a perfectly reasonable position to take. And rather than providing the evidence, rather than exploring that alternative, the missiles began to fly, and basically they rolled out their long-term strategy for perpetual war abroad and domestic dictatorship here at home.
And we actually have an article written at that time. Basically, the Taliban said, well, we'll send bin Laden to another country. You know, certainly we'll send him to another country and can be tried. We'll just send him out of the country. You can pick him up when we send him out of the country.
Sure.
And our response was, well, we not only want bin Laden, we want all the leaders of Al-Qaeda, but we won't tell you who they are. We'll be right back in a moment. And it was unprovoked war. We wanted to go to war. And you read the newspaper articles written at that time. You realize, of course, I mean, how could you possibly give all the Al-Qaeda leaders when you don't even name who they are you want? I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. And everybody who's died over there, tragically, has died for absolutely nothing. And all the civilians that have been killed and the little innocent children that have been killed for nothing. Their blood is not only on the hands of George W. Bush and Colin Powell, but it's on the hands of every American who's not spoken out against this, because men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. Go right ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, I'm afraid that's correct. And one of the things that people have to confront here, those of us who profess to be Christians as well, is that our conduct is not notably better than that of the Muslim radicals whom we abhor. We talk about these people gathering in madrasas and being radicalized and being steeped in militancy, of how they're taught to applaud and promote and support enterprises of terrorism and mass murder. Well, what do you think happens in altogether too many American churches today when we celebrate these deeds of the military supposedly involved in protecting us, when actually they're making war on people who never harmed or threatened us, and in doing so cultivating problems that will blossom into terrorism in the next several years or maybe even sooner? We are caught here in a deadly paradox, in that our behavior is understood by people who are being made our enemies. It's understood as being a constant state, constant threat of aggression against them, and they're on the receiving end of state terrorism that results in reciprocal terrorism, some of it state-sponsored, some of it private, that in turn encourages greater militancy on the part of the government ruling us and more abridgments of our freedoms. If we don't speak out and do what we can to stop this, we're going to end up living in pretty much a fair simulacrum of hell on earth, which is what living in a perpetual state of warfare is like. James Madison, war country, can retain its freedom in the midst of perpetual warfare, and we're proving him right.
Amen to that. Well, our guest, of course, has been William Grigg. We're covering really the tragedy that has led us to where we are today. But, of course, you know, we are spending ourselves into oblivion. We've already put out probably close to $1 trillion, according to Stiglitz, who is an economist, Joseph Stiglitz. This war is going to cost us $3 trillion by the time we take care of all those people. You know, we're already committed to $3 trillion. Where's the money coming from, ladies and gentlemen? Well, that's your retirement fund. That's your health insurance that is gone like yesterday's sunset. William, thanks so much for being with us. God bless. We'll look forward to talking to you next month.
Thanks so much.
Next week.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope you enjoy our regular program every Friday evening with William Grigg. He's certainly one of our most articulate spokesmen, and I do appreciate those of you who have been willing to contribute to his PayPal button. We had him a terrible time getting him to put that PayPal button up, but he did, and I think it's really the sole source of income he has. He's totally dedicated to this battle, and I hope you will be dedicated to this battle as well. Well, this is the time when I really need, of course, to remind you we are having our program. It's going to be on the 17th of October. We're bringing speakers from across the country. We do hope that you'll be able to come. It's at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. You're going to have reservations because we serve lunch. We start early in the morning. We go to 6 o'clock in the evening, 5:30, somewhere in there. And usually people don't want to leave at the end of the day, but we have to, of course, to be stepped down so they can bring somebody. They usually have a program there following us on the evening. But Sydney, if you'd like to come, give us a call. You're going to have reservations, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know what happened on September 11th, we have an interview with a man named Lauro Chavez. It was the last interview with Lauro before he disappeared. Nobody's heard of him, to my knowledge, since then. I've never been able to track him down again. And you go up in the Internet, you look up Lauro Chavez, L-A-U-R, Sergeant Lauro Chavez, and all sorts of terrible things, how he lied, how he wasn't in the military. Why the people who wrote these articles even called CENTCOM headquarters, and they had no record of him being there. Ladies and gentlemen, how many of you do you think you could call CENTCOM, that central command, CENTCOM headquarters, and ask if Lauro Chavez was there on September 11th. These are obviously plant articles, because Lauro Chavez told me that on that morning there was a stand-down order that there would be no planes launched if there were hijackings, and number two, that there were a number of military exercises that morning simulated terrorists hijacking American planes and crashing them into buildings. And you remember, of course, Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of the National Security Advisor, saying, why, who could have ever thought that they would hijack our planes and crash them into buildings? And she was lying through her teeth. She was part and parcel of this whole cover-up. And it is a cover-up, ladies and gentlemen. The murderers are still at large because, of course, Building 7 was a controlled demolition. We have two four-tape sets, a 911, 911, a 911 update. We have another tape set. Why did the buildings come down? We've got great DVDs. You need to see them. And you need to show them to others. The murderers are still at large. The murderers are still at large. In fact, six of the hijackers are alive and well over in the Middle East. And you can look this up on the Internet. Don't accept what I say. You explain to me, ladies and gentlemen, how they could have been in those terror, those planes crashing, you know, suddenly crashing into the buildings, crashing into the Pentagon, and they'd be alive and well. How could that happen? If you can explain that to me, I will certainly agree that this was the government's conspiracy theory is correct. And the government's conspiracy story is that 19 extremely intelligent Islamic terrorists were able to outwit the FBI and the CIA. They were out able to actually schedule their hijackings on the very day when the military had 15 different military exercises, five of them simulating hijacking planes and crashing into buildings. And then, of course, Osama bin Laden had to smuggle those explosives into Building 7 so that could be brought down to controlled demolition later in the day. That's the government's conspiracy theory, and if you believe that, well, you can believe that if you want to. But I think it's much easier to believe that we've not been told the truth, and that they wanted a war, and somebody, I don't know who it was, but somebody murdered almost 3,000 Americans that day, and they're still loose out there, just like they left our boys at Pearl Harbor to die, and they knew the attack was coming. If you would like to see Secretary of War Simpson's diary, we have it, where he talks about going to the White House on the 25th, and the president said, the attack will probably come next Monday. The only question is how we get into the war. Get the Japanese to fire the first shot on number 1-800-544-8927.